Accession number 13271, reel 5.
I believe it's about this time that your aunt was murdered. Am I right in thinking that?
Yes. I had been fetching about 2 years, just over. And, less than 2 years now, when I think about it. Because this was March 1984 when she was murdered. And I was still number three, in fact. The boy was still there, about to be sacked. And, of course, this completely turned my world upside down. And just when I thought I was settling into this rustic idyll, I was thrown into this nightmare. And...
Could you tell me what actually happened?
Yes. I'll try not to go on too much about it. What happened was that I heard that she was missing. This was on March 24th, 1984. Got a phone call from a relation, not the police. And then later that day, we heard that a body had been found. I knew straight away that it was Hilda. I just had that feeling. And I knew I had to get up to her house in Shrewsbury and retrieve a paper that she had written criticising the government's white paper on radioactive waste management policy. And she was planning to go to present it at the Sizewell B inquiry into the first pressurised water reactor to be built in this country. And I then knew I had to pursue the truth about her death. And I feared that the nuclear industry was responsible. That was all a gut feeling. I went up there very quickly with my brother-in-law. Of course, it was all in the papers. It was a very strange case in which she had been apparently abducted in her own car from her home the previous Wednesday, on the 21st of March. And then the car had been reported to the police later that day. Crashed in a ditch 5 miles outside Shrewsbury, abandoned. Police knew who owned it within about 40 minutes, phoned the address, telephone number, got no reply, did nothing more for 2 days. Farmer went back several times with complaints, they didn't move. Until Friday, then they half-heartedly sent someone round to the house, found it all open, didn't really do anything about it. It wasn't until the Saturday morning that they really began a search, at which time one of the relations had caught up with this and was beginning to ask questions. And the police said that this was a burglary that had gone tragically wrong, but the more I looked into it, the more it didn't add up. And I found that they weren't asking basic questions and they weren't interested in the nuclear angle. And then people began to come forward. And we had a BT engineer come forward who said he had checked both her phones for the police and found that they had been interfered with in a professional way, and yet the police were saying that the phone had just been ripped out. I had later a policeman come forward from the police station to say he would be prepared to tell me what had been going on in the police station, but not until I'd solved the case. He was fearful for his job. And incidentally, the BT engineer said the same. And so it went on. And the more I inquired, the more suspicious I became that there was a cover-up going on. And so many things didn't add up. It was a very bizarre business. I did find her paper, as I fully expected to. It was in its final draft form. It needed referencing, and in fact it needed shortening a bit, because she had become a bit repetitive. I managed to find a retired nuclear scientist who she had gone to for nuclear physics lessons, called Don Arnott, who lives near Welshpool, who knew nothing about this paper and was staggered when he read it, because it was so good. He helped me tidy it up, and I then applied to the inquiry at Sizewell to read it into the record. And they agreed, although there wasn't even a registered objector. And it was finally, I think, in September of 84 that I went to Snape Maltings in Suffolk and read the paper into the transcript. I couldn't be questioned on it because it wasn't my work. And that was my initiation into opposing the nuclear industry. And I then went back to pursue the truth about her death. And the next twist occurred just after the inquest, which had been a complete whitewash, in which I was unable to bring forward certain witnesses. There was clearly a conspiracy between the police, the pathologist, and the coroner to just exclude anything that didn't fit their theory of a burglary that went tragically wrong. I was in despair. And then suddenly I had 2 hours' warning from Paddy Ashdown, who was not my actual constituency MP, but he was geographically quite near at Yeovil, that Tan Dl, Maverick Labour MP, was going to stand up in Parliament at an adjournment debate just before Christmas in 1984 and announce under parliamentary privilege that he had information that my aunt's murder was nothing to do with the nuclear industry, it was all to do with the sinking of the Belgrano, that I had been under suspicion on leaving the Navy, that I had taken some documents with me which personally incriminated Mrs. Thatcher. I had left them for safekeeping with Hilda, and they had broken in to try and retrieve them because Mr. DL was getting good information from someone who they didn't know who it was, and they suspected it was me. Because I had gone into thatching, and therefore they assumed I was disaffected, and that she had surprised them, had fought, and they had disposed of her. And Mr. DL, of course, was hopelessly pro-nuclear, talked about being a personal friend of Lord Marshall, who ran the nuclear industry at the time. A perfect man to set up. He had not checked the source of this latest information, which he subsequently admitted to me came in a suspicious way, and he had run with it. And I had the world's press at my door the following morning, thinking that I was DL's deep throat and that I should spill the beans and bring down Mrs. Thatcher. Which I assured the press that I would not, and I did not. I had not done any of these things that I had been accused of in Parliament, and incidentally one of them was that I had sent the signal to Signor Belgrano, so he didn't know what he was talking about. And I even had the producer of World in Action staying with us at the time. He'd been tipped off by Mr. DL, and he said, "Come on, Rob, it's your duty to do this. Bring down Mrs. Thatcher. We can make a great program out of this." And I said, "Come off it." But I was under great pressure. I wrote to Admiral Fieldhouse, who was First Sea Lord, to explain what was going on, to ask to meet him, to say I was loyal. He wrote back my return of post, and this was over Christmas. It was wonderful. Typical of the man. And said, "Have no fear. I have never doubted your loyalty. And just let's do sleeping dogs lie." And my wife and I then just escaped to a hotel in the West Country for the new year to get away from the press. 3 weeks later, the first television program went out on Harlech Television about my aunt's case. They had asked that I should be in the studio with Tam DL. I refused. But I was interviewed separately in my aunt's old house. And they challenged DL in the studio as to whether he might have been set up. It had never occurred to him before, and to give him his due, he said that my hitherto reliable source had passed me this information. 30 hours later, there was a half-hearted arson attack on my aunt's second home, which was a cottage up on the Welsh border. A very strange arson attack, which was not a Welsh nationalist type one, which is normally diesel-soaked rags on windowsills with nightlights. It's all over by 3 o'clock in the morning. This was smouldering newspaper in a tea chest of logs outside her back door. There was a water butt alongside, which was full. There was a bucket which hadn't been taken away or hadn't had a hole knocked in it. Sure enough, when the neighbour saw the smoke, which actually this thing detonated at 8 o'clock on a Saturday morning, he was able to come up and put it out. Although it had burnt away the back door and the window. The first fireman on the scene was immediately suspicious that this was different, and he thought it was a warning to me to get off the grass. I discovered I couldn't even find him for 18 months. When I found him, I discovered he'd been framed on some trumped-up charge because he wanted to talk to the press about it. The police put a complete clamp on the place and ran me around for all that time before I could actually get at the facts. And I believe that the nuclear industry was reduced to intimidating me because the Belgrano card had backfired. And now Tandiel had unwittingly raised my aunt's torch, and they were reduced to this. I subsequently had a tire slashed outside Don Arnott's front door. A year later, in fact, when I was being very rude about the police and promoting our concerns about the case, and the police did not investigate that properly. And that, of course, was a warning to Don as well as me, because it was his front door. This is the retired scientist that Hilda went to, and he offered his help, incidentally, on the case, which was wonderful, and he's been applying his scientific expertise to the case very well, and we made great advances. And it was then that he revealed that he had been under surveillance. He knew by nuclear industry agents at the time that Hilda had been to him for nuclear physics lessons. He was about to go to Sizewell himself to raise concerns that he had about the design of the pressurized water reactor, specifically the low melting point of the control rod alloy, which he believed was the reason that the Three Mile Island core melted partially before it was shut down by luck, and that this problem, this design flaw, is inherent in the British design and in the French, and that this was something they could not change, and that the fear was that he had briefed Hilda on this. It wasn't her own information that was a problem. She said nothing new or dangerous to the nuclear industry. But it was this information that was absolute dynamite, and that they needed to abduct her to question her about her sources, because they didn't believe that she had written her paper anyway. Probably Don must have written it, because he was an expert on radioactive waste. And then he could not have found out about the control rod flaw himself, that he must have had a mole who had passed it to him from within the nuclear industry, and they were determined to find the mole. And that they therefore abducted her in an Ulster snatch squad technique, using her own car as a decoy, with two thugs in it, one of them disguised as her, while they actually abducted her in their own vehicle to a safe house, which we believe we have identified. It's a wooden, mobile, windowless stable that was the nearest building to where her body was found. They interrogated her for 2 days, which is why the police had to be told not to do anything. And, of course, she was very resistant because she didn't know anything. They tortured her, and then we believe they literally gave her an overdose of morphine, in fact, in her abdomen, used knife wounds to cover the puncture marks, put her out in this wood, stripped her from the waist down. She did, in fact, die of hypothermia. And then the cover-up began. And, of course, she was very much left to be found as an example to discourage others. And this was a deliberate operation. It went well. And this was the US-UK nuclear power industry working out of control, not MI5. This was private enterprise, as admired by Mrs. Thatcher. And MI5 only came into it in terms of the cover-up. And, of course, the whole Belgrano angle was a deliberate attempt to smear me, and hopefully that I would be, in fact, disaffected, would overreact at my personal involvement in my aunt's murder, would spill the beans about the Belgrano before Ponting case, so they were confident that they could then nail me in the Official Secrets Act, convince a jury that I was disaffected, and put me away, and that would be the end of the pursuit of the truth, and the nuclear industry would be safe. And I have good information to that effect, but I do not have proof. Anyway, that radicalised me. I realised that the whole of British society and the establishment had been corrupted by nuclearism, and that I had to oppose it. However, I resisted getting actively involved, other than pursuing the truth about my aunt's murder, until Chernobyl. And then I realised I could not stay passive anymore, and so I began to campaign more openly against nuclear power, but I did not touch nuclear weapons. That was the ultimate taboo. And so I was able to rationalise, as I had done with my aunt, that power and weapons could be separated. I now know that is mistaken. She never argued about it. She allowed me to do this. And I continued to do this until the Gulf War. But I then had the Hinckley Point C inquiry come up in 1988, which was the second inquiry into a pressurized water reactor in this country. It was not far from where I lived, down in the West Country, and so I registered as a local objector, an independent objector, and I decided to try to present Don Arnott's case about the control rod alloy, but he refused to appear to start with as my expert witness because he said he wasn't qualified. He advised me to get an American pressurized water reactor expert, which I did, Dr. Richard Webb, who had worked for Admiral Rickover on the prototype pressurized water reactor at Shipping Port. I spent a lot of Hilda's bequest on sponsoring him, and we did present a very strong case against all the safety problems. But the one thing he would not touch, which was the great twist, was the control rod problem, because he hadn't studied it. He'd missed it too. And so I then had to do that on my own. But Don then came in, and I got him in as a late expert witness, and so we did raise that as well ourselves, but because it was late, we were outmaneuvered by the nuclear industry, and they didn't answer most of our difficult questions. But we did get more information, which strengthened Don's hypothesis about the control rod problem. But it was brushed aside in the report. But I learnt a lot about the nuclear power industry, how ruthless it was, and how powerful. But still, I didn't go near nuclear weapons. Although I had begun to realise that all my fears about Trident were coming to fruition, with the beginning of real defence cuts in the Navy. And then, of course, you had the collapse of the Soviet Union, and the main rationale for Trident went with it. And I could see that Trident was going to become a liability. But still, I didn't want to speak out. And I was not pushed into this until the build-up to the Gulf War. I was happy with the United Nations' initial strategy, which was laying siege to Iraq pending sanctions and strong negotiations and public pressure on Saddam Hussein. But then I heard the news that Bush had doubled the number of troops unilaterally, and I realised that we were in for a punitive expedition, and that this was going to be to take out Saddam Hussein's war machine. We were obviously going to have to attack the heart of it, and that this would provoke Saddam to attack Israel. And I feared that Saddam might overreact or not be able to control his own military, and that if a chemical-headed scud was ever fired at Israel, then no one could have stopped Shamir from responding with a nuclear strike in Baghdad, especially when the Israelis knew that the West Germans had provided the technology for the chemical head. Holocaust memories. And I believe that Seymour Hersh, in his book The Samson Option, all about the development of the Israeli bomb, had very good information that after the first Scud attack on Tel Aviv, all the Israelis did was wheel out their nuclear weapons so that the American satellites could see them. and total panic. Bush racing to Shamir saying, I will do anything for you not to react. What do you want? $10 billion, please, and we'll see how we go from there. And, of course, thank God, no chemical-headed Scuds were fired. But 38 more Scud missiles hit Israel. And the Israeli people were cowering in their basements, wearing gas masks. And they must have been wondering where their nuclear deterrent had got to. All very well saying that the Allies were covering for them, but they weren't stopping the Scud missiles hitting them. And there were casualties. And they were civilians. And so this really, I feared this was going to happen. And then when it did happen, as far as I was concerned, I was vindicated. And that this showed that the Israeli bomb had not done its job, that it was actually a liability, not an asset. Because we then had the coalition justification was Saddam's bomb, suddenly. This was the final justification which apparently public opinion was supporting. Wasn't supporting the rest. But if there was a bomb, yes, they would allow it. And I realised that there were two other angles to this. One of which was that it was the Israeli bomb that gave Saddam his pretext of going for his own. Secondly, how relieved Mr. Bush must have been that no one had managed to sell power-generating reactors to Iraq. Because in order to take out the electricity generation system in Iraq, they were going to have to bomb them. And the third point was that, of course, Saddam could well have survived a nuclear strike on Baghdad because he did have the best anti-nuclear bunkers that Western technology could build for him. And what would have happened if that had occurred and Saddam had been sitting on the top of the radiated ruin as cock of the dung heap, so to speak, in Iraq and of the Arab world, and the whole of the Arab world undoubtedly would have erupted in outrage against Israel and her friends, and Israel's security would have been destroyed forever. And in the midst of all this, we have the IRA attack on the Gulf War cabinet with mortar bombs from a van in Whitehall. Where was Polaris? That is not a facetious question anymore, because the terrorist threat is the biggest threat that this country faces, and it was demonstrated graphically by that. And I was told sniffily by a civil servant from the Ministry of Defence when I asked him that question that Polaris was not designed for this. So what was it designed for, and what is its use now, and where is it targeted, and so on. And for me, the whole deterrence doctrine had collapsed, and it was a myth, and I felt a sense of betrayal for the Royal Navy, and that we had now got to stop Trident from ultimately destroying the Navy. So that was my run into the Gulf War, and that's what was needed to break me out of my brainwashing taboo. And it was very traumatic. And what I was actually having to break out of was all my indoctrination, which people say they don't feel indoctrinated, but you don't know until you've broken out of it. And it is a very subtle thing, because we're not fanatics in the British military. It is the deep tribal loyalties. It is the status problem, the fact that you're apparently the only one in step as well, as my pre-training instructor used to tell me. And then there is the pressure on the families, and I know that several of my colleagues in the Navy support my feelings, but cannot break out because they've got families, they've got themselves locked into the system of boarding school allowance and what have you. I didn't have children. I had that freedom. There is the whole insidious business of status within the British establishment, which is very strong. Getting a job, things like this. If you are smeared in any way as being a traitor, and I did feel when I finally came to speak out from the foot of Nelson's Column, of all places, in Trafalgar Square, on the 12th of January 1991, that I was committing high treason. And I fully expected a snatch squad to come out of the crowd from MI5 and take me to the Tower. I mean, I was in that state of mind. I wasn't enjoying it. And I was in a state of shock. Because I felt I was letting down the military. And I then, of course, came under the spotlight as I was a novelty for C&D. And incidentally, I never joined C&D. I quite carefully joined ex-services C&D, because I felt that C&D was discredited and burned out, and I wanted to keep some sense of attachment to my military service, because I did believe in the Royal Navy and the military. And I remember a moment when I was appearing on television with Colonel Michael Dewar. First time I come up against him. I think he's Deputy Director of the International Institute of Strategic Studies. And it was the morning after the first Scud attack on Israel. So this was, of course, my moment when I could say, I told you so. And I thought I ought to introduce myself to him, and he was pretty nervous about me, but he said, well, I respect your views, old boy, but you have to wear your heart on your sleeve. And I said, it's not my heart, it's my brain. And he just turned away. Couldn't handle it. And I realised, of course, that we are into the area of dogma, of heresy. This is Inquisition stuff. This is not rational thought. And I also realised that in order to hold my position, I had to do my homework about the history of the bomb, and I had been working very hard on that. And I actually found it very interesting. I had never bothered to look at it, because I had been told not to think about it. And I found, for instance, that Britain has a considerable responsibility for the creation of the bomb. The Americans did not want to build it until the British persuaded them, first of all, of the feasibility and of the urgency of doing so in the Maud Report in 1941. And then they, of course, became accomplice in the Manhattan Project. And then, I believe, history will admit one day that Britain became Saddam Hussein's role model. The first medium-sized power with delusions of grandeur to threaten nuclear terrorism. Because this is what it's all about. And in fact, I have seriously heard it suggested that one of the main reasons the British have got the bomb is because of the French. We're thinking in terms of Napoleonic Wars still. And the French, likewise. And let's face it, the French have got perhaps more reason to feel insecure after their experience in Verdun in the First World War, and then the occupation, Nazi occupation, than we have. And let's face it, we should have more confidence in this country. We did, after all, win in the Napoleonic War. We won Trafalgar, and we have all these great achievements of empire and medicine and science and engineering and so on, in which really did lead the world, and sport. And still, we seem to allow Suez to collapse that into an awful state of inferiority complex, which Macmillan was crawling to Kennedy for the bomb. And when we lost, was it Blue Steel? He demanded Polaris. And I suspect poor Admiral Mountbatten must be regretting ever having gone for it, but at the time it seemed the best thing to go for, and it was the fascination, of course, of the nuclear thing, and the nuclear submarine, was no doubt about it, was very potent as a military machine, and so that's how we got slid into it in the Navy. But that's what Polaris was all about, and now we were going for Trident, and I really did feel that this was a complete scam which had been put out through a well-oiled machine propaganda for the last 40 years, and now all the politicians, all the establishment had to, and the church, had to sort of go along with it in order to be accepted as members of the establishment and rise to the top in it. And so there was a lot of loss of face at stake here. And this is what we've got to try to find a way around. And